This is kind of an overview of the universe. Maybe we should have just started with this and we could have ended. And the idea here is that it sort of captures a bunch of the different things that we've been talking about throughout this course. Obviously, we talked about these galaxy things and all that stuff that's inside of galaxies for a good part of the course. But we also talked about galaxies as being sort of attached to a metric, right? Attached to space-time. And what you can see pictured here is a depiction of how space-time is actually changing with time. So if time is moving from the left-hand side to the right-hand side, you can see that we're currently in a period of expansion and acceleration. Earlier on, we were in a period of expansion, but it was an important moment of deceleration. And early on in the universe, as we'll wind up seeing in the last lecture this evening, there was a great inflation, a very rapid expansion of the universe in the first moments of the universe creation after the Big Bang. A good part of what we'll wind up talking about today is this stuff right here. This is called the cosmic background radiation. It's an important moment in the history of the universe, a decoupling of radiation and matter. Okay, so before we get to that, let's do some logistics. Reading chapter 30, as you hopefully know by now, we're coming to the end. Chapter 30 is the last chapter that I'll ask you to look through. You obviously won't have to know all of what's in chapter 30. It, like many other chapters, sort of overdense with material that is somewhat extraneous. So focus on the things that I'm talking about in this lecture and the next lecture this evening. Last lecture this evening, as you know, is in Evans 264, so it's in the talc room, and we'll start promptly at 5:10, and there will be pizza. So if you have any like special dietary restrictions or something like that, you can email it to Adam, because he's going to be the pizza person, just as an extra incentive. I know you really want to see the last lecture, because it's going to be awesome anyway, but pizza, added inducement. I guess we can also get some sodas or something like that, too, right? Right. Okay. The other big news, of course, is that we now have a date and time for our trip to Lick Observatory. It's next Monday. So, what, 6 days or so from now. And we'll leave Campbell Hall around 3:30 in a big caravan and head up to Mount Hamilton. It takes about 2 hours to get there. They ask that we're there by 6:30 sharp. We'll then kind of do a long walking tour of the observatory, and if the weather cooperates, we'll get to look through a few telescopes. So for us to sort of rapidly ramp up the organization of that, I'll ask that you go to this website, bit.ly/lick-trip, and sort of give us your name and whether you want to come. And most importantly, we're hoping that some of you actually have a car, or at least access to a car, and wouldn't mind driving some of your peers up to the mountain. So that's obviously really important. We're hopefully going to be able to get at least 15 of you to come. That's sort of the basic minimum requirement when they do these tours. So please try to go to, again, for those that are listening on the internet because you're not here in class today, bit.ly/lick-trip, and fill out the form to let us know. I assume some people are actually listening on the internet, right? Maybe not. Those of you that are not in this class and listening on the internet on iTunes, you're not allowed to come to Lick. All right, I have no office hours today. I will have office hours next week. I figure 3 hours of me today is probably enough. Also, I have something else going on. Final is on May 13th from 8 to 11 a.m., it will be a 2 hour and 50 minute long exam. And you can expect roughly twice as many questions as we've had in the midterm. And obviously, as I've said a number of times, we're biasing this final towards the last one third of the class, basically after the second midterm. There will be sort of integrative questions where we ask you to sort of synthesize the information you've been digesting and intuiting over the last several months, but for the most part, we're going to be focusing on cosmology in the final. That's going to be in Evans 60. It's a much bigger room than this, so we'll be able to spread out, et cetera. And in preparation for that, there will be a review on May 6th, a week before that. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that we decided last time that was going to be from 11 to 2 p.m. in Evans 264. Did I get that right? Okay. And last, I think we had said when we handed out the extra credit project ideas that they would be due next Wednesday during the RRR period. But I think just to make it easy, if you want to turn them in the review section on May 6th, that's fine, and we'll accept them up until then. Okay, so that's it. That's all I had on logistics. Are there any questions? Okay. Right, so last time we had a discussion about measuring distance not on small scales but on large scales. And we said obviously there are kind of two major ways of doing this. There's standard candles and there are standard rulers. And the sort of cocktail answer to the statement of how you make measurements of distance as astronomers is that there is no standard candle and there is no standard ruler in astronomy. What we talk about when we say standard rulers and standard candles is something that's standardizable. That is, we can learn something about the basic physics of the source that we're observing or sets of sources that we're observing and make some inferences about how to correct what we see on the sky to what we think is actually happening physically. Because it's that connection between what we see on the sky, in either on if we're looking at standard rulers, a total size and angular size, or total brightness if we're talking about a standard candle. It's basically being able to infer from multiple properties of the source what the intrinsic physical size is or what the intrinsic physical luminosity is. We haven't yet talked about standard rulers in the context of cosmology. That'll be a discussion that we get into today. But just to refresh our memory, remember we said that flux is luminosity divided by 4 pi dl squared. And now we're subscripting distances in astronomy with L because there's a concept of a luminosity distance. This is, by definition, true. And then the question is, in the context of cosmology and an expanding universe, what is dl? Remember, we said that dl is equal to the proper distance times 1 plus z. So it's not exactly the proper distance. It's not exactly the distance between us and that source instantaneously today in whatever the age of the universe turns out to be. It's slightly different than that. We have to multiply it by 1 plus z. Does anyone remember why we had to multiply dl by 1 plus z? Or sorry, dp by 1 plus z to get dl? There were two effects that we considered when we thought about this equation here. Yes? Time dilation. What does time dilation do? Yeah, it messes with the photon arrival time. So photons are arriving more slowly because they're coming from a source which is coming from very far away in this expanding universe. And then likewise, in addition to that, what's the other effect? That's right. So each photon is losing energy. And so if we look at the units of flux, of course, this is units of joules per second per meter squared. Meter squared is a reference to the size of our detector, basically. Joules are going down because each photon that's leaving this source is arriving to us with less energy because of gravitational redshift. And the time between the arrival time of these sources is actually increasing. So both effects serve to decrease the overall flux from what you might expect naively if you just put in proper distance. And both of those go like 1 plus z, so we have to put in a factor of 1 plus z here. Okay, so the nice thing is then if we can measure flux and we can infer the luminosity because we have a standard candle or standardizable candle, it means that we can measure the luminosity distance to the source. That is, we can measure the distance between us and that source either today or the total amount of distance that those photons had to travel, which is actually the thing that we're measuring here. That's very useful, of course, because we know that dl is going to be some function of the Hubble constant and all the other cosmological parameters today. And we said for small redshift, the luminosity distance can be written as c times z divided by h naught, 1 plus z divided by 2, 1 minus 1 half omega matter as observed today plus omega lambda as observed today. And the implication, of course, is very clear. If we had a source whose luminosity we knew, we could measure its luminosity distance or infer its luminosity distance. If we measure that source at some redshift, then we have a simultaneous constraint on omega matter and omega lambda. And because we think we can measure omega matter by local observations that don't make reference to the expanding universe, basically counting up dark matter and ordinary matter in the local universe, we can actually start getting some traction on the measurement of omega lambda. And just so you have it, remember we said that the Hubble constant as a function of redshift in general is h naught 1 plus z omega matter of 0, 1 plus z plus omega photon today, 1 plus z squared plus omega lambda today divided by 1 plus z squared plus 1 minus omega 0 to the 1 half power. You don't have to memorize this. The important thing when you look at an equation like this, or we give you an equation like this and ask you to work things out, is to understand that if we're looking in the local universe, so this is sort of z less than about 1, if we're looking in the local universe, then this term here isn't all that important because it's very, very small to begin with. Does anyone remember what the order of magnitude of this omega photon is today? One? Thousand? 10 to the minus 3? Yeah, it's like 10 to the minus 6. It's more like 10 to the minus 5. So this is a really small number today, so you'd have to go to really high redshift for this to get something which is comparable to 0.73 for omega lambda and omega matter 0.23 or thereabouts. And so when we actually take the limit when z is small, we wind up getting rid of this term here, and then you can just sort of plug in for what omega total is today. Remember, when we subscript omega just with a naught, that's saying omega total, which is the summation of these three terms here today. Of course, there's also omega changing as a function of time as well. Okay, any questions about that? Yes? Where? That? That? That should not be squared, I don't believe. No. Nice try. All right, so the other thing we pointed out towards the end of class last time is that when we now think about magnitudes, and we think about the apparent magnitude little m minus big M, remember this is just defined to be 5 log d divided by 10 parsecs. This is the distance modulus, right? We've always just sort of said d because we said, hey, distance is distance, right? If I know the distance in units of megaparsecs, I'm done. But in a cosmological sense, we subscript this with an L. And I gave you the functional form for what the distance modulus actually is in this lowish redshift limit. And the implication here is that supernovae look fainter for a universe with a lambda term not equal to 0. You can see that again from that equation up there. If I turn on omega lambda and it was 0 otherwise for a fixed omega matter, then it makes the luminosity distance just a larger quantity for a given redshift, right? So if I observe a supernova at some redshift, it's going to wind up looking fainter if I have an omega to a minute. And we also talked at the very end about this idea that we probably can rule out normal dust as a way of kind of wiggling out the existence of omega lambda. The existence of this dark energy term, for those that remember the history of this, is that it was inferred from supernovae observations by a group here. Saul Primer is the leader of that up at LBL, and he's a physics professor here on campus as well, and another group. And both groups wound up inferring that supernovae at redshifts around a half or getting up to redshift of one were fainter than they ought to be if there wasn't this cosmological constant. But many people were saying, well, it could just be sort of strange dust. Maybe they just appear to be dimmer because of the existence of dust, which doesn't also give rise to reddening. So then the dust would have to be different. But there are ways to test that, and now we've sort of started ruling out most models of dust. The universe have to be sort of pretty pernicious to be confusing us and tell us that there's this extra term when it's actually some ordinary stuff that we don't know about. Right. So we can take supernovae data, and we can make a measurement of omega matter and omega lambda. Realize, of course, that if all I had was supernovae data, well, I could measure Hubble constant, right, by just looking at the expansion of the universe nearby. I could make a bunch of different measurements for every different source and get a better measurement of omega matter and omega lambda. But you can't actually just isolate the two of those things. They actually vary when I change one, and I have to decrease another if I increase one, right? So these two things are intimately connected with each other. And what I'll plot here is omega lambda of 0 and omega matter of 0. And we'll go 1, 2, 1, 2. Omega 0 is equal to 1 universe, which is what we think the answer is a line that looks like this. What supernova data wind up telling us is that we indeed intersect this line, but with a great deal of uncertainty exactly where the data actually wind up telling us the universe lives. So if you've ever looked at these plots before, you wind up seeing contours. These are basically, for those that have done some work in probability theory or statistics, know that when you make a measurement, you can't actually measure it precisely. So if you're making a measurement of one number, you might sort of have a range of allowed values of that number. But you actually, if you're measuring now two numbers simultaneously, the two of these things are actually sort of talking to each other. So this is sort of the allowed range from supernovae data, purely in a statistical sense. Because we're making measurements, they have errors associated with them. And what's interesting is that sort of within the best fit part of this range, you can have these what are called error contours. There is this overlap of this whole contour of what's allowed with this omega 0 equals 1 universe. And so this was sort of the first set of indications that omega lambda was not equal 0. And the early indications was it was something like 0.7 omega matter. Was obviously not zero because we have matter in the universe, and this was something like 0.3. The whole game now, observationally in cosmology, is to take a look at this map right here of these two allowed parameters and do your darndest to make these error regions smaller and try to narrow in on the exact answer. We now have a good understanding from many other different techniques of us actually now closing in on this region here where omega lambda is about 2 or 2.5 times the size of omega matter today. Okay. So that's sort of a brief statement or at least summary of what we've learned from supernovae. And now I want to get back into standard rulers and talk about how we make measurements of distance in cosmology, now not in the context of apparent brightness or apparent flux, but in the context of apparent size on the sky. Any questions before I move on? Okay. So let's get back to basics here, because remember when we were talking about and defining the luminosity distance dl, we just said, well, we always thought of flux as equaling luminosity divided by 4 pi r squared or d squared. Angular diameter distance. Is sort of similar. And here we just define the angular diameter distance, now where I subscript it with an A for angular. It's just going to be the size of some source, script DL, divided by theta. Theta is the apparent size. And L is the actual size in units of, you know, say meters or something. Apparent size would be in units of radians here. Okay, so how do we do this in cosmology? Well, remember how we did proper distance in cosmology? We actually had to do some integrals. When we thought about the travel path of a photon to figure out what its proper distance is, we had to think about it moving through this sort of expanding universe. Now we're sort of in a better place, or at least an easier place. And what is it when we think about photons that have left a source and we're now making a measurement of the size of that source? Here's this source. We'll call it a galaxy. It will have a physical size L. And we're going to wind up observing it at a very, very far away distance. And obviously what we'll wind up seeing here is this angle theta. The nice thing about this is, if we think about this in a cosmological sense, what's actually happening is we're making a measurement of two points of light that have left the outskirts of whatever we're going to wind up calling the physical size of this galaxy. And so when did these photons leave? In the time of the universe, those photons left at the same time. And remember, when we think about coordinate distances, did those photons leave at different distances from us, or they leave at the same distance? We're basically going to wind up positing that they left at the same distance from us, and we'll call it our varpi. These two things are not exactly the same, because this is the coordinate distance and this is the physical distance, and obviously there are 1 plus z factors here that we have to worry about. So, but the nice thing here is that dr varpi is equal to 0. So if you look back at the Robertson-Walker metric, and we now try to figure out what equations we have to solve to get our ds squared. Ds squared, or the integral of the negative of ds squared, is just going to wind up being this L. It's just going to wind up being this proper distance here. Ds squared, if we go back to the Robertson-Walker metric, is just going to be minus the dimensionless scale factor of the universe squared times r varpi squared times d theta squared. It's the second term of the spatial coordinates in the Robertson-Walker metric. The first term goes away because that's as a function of d r varpi, but that's equal to 0. The first term, the time term, also goes to 0 because those photons are basically leaving and heading towards us at the same time in the history of the universe, because those photons are arriving to us at exactly the same moment. Right, again, when we think about measurements of distance, you want to do it as an observer where you're measuring the distance of something at exactly the same time. So this makes things a lot easier. Obviously, the minus cancels, all the squares wind up canceling, and we wind up integrating this d theta on the sky And that just becomes very trivial. We wind up having that L is equal to R of t, R var b times theta, as we wind up observing. So looking at this immediately, we can wind up associating dA with just R of t times R var b. We'll do a little something tricky here, and we're going to divide by the dimension of the scale factor today, which is fine because that's just 1. I'll also multiply by the dimension of the scale factor here today. What's this equation here? What's this term here? R of t divided by R0. No. So remember, we're talking about the change of the scale factor of the universe, right? So we're saying that R of t was a bigger or smaller number farther back in time. It was smaller, right? Today, we say that this is equal to 1. R of t divided by R naught today, in terms of redshift, is just... No, Hubble constant, remember, talks about the dynamics of the universe. So the Hubble constant is R dot divided by R today, or at any time in the universe. This is a number. This is actually an observable. This is talking about the ratio of the scale factor of the universe as it is today relative to the scale factor of the universe when the light left this galaxy. Yes? Yep. Or is it 1 plus C or 1 over 1 plus C? Is this number smaller than 1 or greater than 1? R of t at, say, redshift of 1 was what? Yeah. So we want to have something which gets to be smaller when redshift is bigger. What is this right here? This is a little bit more complicated. In terms of things that we've already talked about today, it's not dr var p, right, over something. We're actually integrating photons. This is just a number times another number here. In effect, we've already done the integral. It's just the proper distance. It's the proper distance between us and that source today. So d proper divided by 1 plus z. This is really interesting now because it means that if we want to relate the luminosity distance to the angular diameter distance, dA is equal to the luminosity distance divided by 1 plus z squared, where we've just gotten rid of the proper distance in both equations up there and down here. That's strange, right? I mean, it should come off as somewhat strange. It means that there are two ways of thinking about distance, and those measurements of distance are different from each other and depend on redshift. So that you normally think like the way I make measurements of, say, parallax in the local universe shouldn't be any different than the way I make measurements using the 1 over r squared law. But in cosmology, in an expanding universe, that's actually not true. They're actually different. Let's see how that difference winds up manifesting itself. Well, the good thing is at low redshift, those distances are the same. So your intuition in the local universe is not actually wrong. If you make the measurement of a galaxy whose size you know, and you make the measurement of a supernova, whose luminosity you know, you're going to get the same distance in units of megaparsecs. However, things sort of start changing as you wind up going to higher and higher redshift. WMAP is a satellite that we're going to wind up talking about later today that has made measurements, the most precise measurements of the cosmological parameters. So this is sort of the numbers that your book has been using when we talk about omega lambda equal 0.73, et cetera. but there are some other universes there. What's really strange about this is as you go beyond redshift of about 1, the angular diameter distance sort of winds up turning over. And sources, which are, say, at redshift of 5, are actually at the same angular diameter distance as sources that are redshift of 0.5 in the universe we live in. And if you take this to its logical extreme, as you go to higher and higher redshift, sources which are an incredibly high redshift are actually at low angular diameter distance. We'll wind up seeing that sort of the angular diameter distance between us and the cosmic background radiation is about 11 megaparsecs. It's as if sources which are farther away are actually not as far away, right? We think of these things, and we like to think about distances in terms of now what I've been basically hammering it into you. The higher the redshift, the farther away they are, the earlier in the universe when the light left that source to get to us. So it's just natural to think about it about as farther away. And that's true. That intuition actually is actually right when we think about luminosity distance. I'll draw up sort of a schematic of that in a second. But sources which have some physical size associated with them, it's as if the farther away I move or the higher redshift I go, the actual bigger they wind up appearing on the sky. It's very counterintuitive, but it winds up coming out of our derivation from the Robertson-Walker metric. And I guess there's no real easy way to think about this, but one intuition that I've sort of developed over the years is that we think about this sort of Big Bang, and we think about when the universe was super compact. When the universe was super compact, there were photons, effectively, that headed towards us, but we were moving away from those photons. And those photons, at the time that they left, were actually really close to us. So it's as if the whole universe was sort of on top of us at early times. And so we start looking at sources which are basically have been emitting since the beginning of the universe, and we're observing those photons now. It's as if all this stuff is kind of right over us. Just to hammer this home, I'll plot a schematic of the luminosity distance relative to the angular diameter distance in the universe that we live in. This is some units of, say, megaparsecs or something like this. And obviously, the luminosity distance as a function of redshift is just increasing, right? As I go to higher redshift, I've plotted this linearly, but I also haven't told you whether I'm doing this log or whatever. It's monotonically increasing as I go to higher and higher redshift, the luminosity distance. At low redshifts, I wind up having the same answer for the angular diameter distance, and then I wind up sort of departing from that, and then I wind up turning over. And with the cosmological parameters we have, sort of z max for the angular diameter distance is something like 1.7. So if I had a ruler of size 1 meter, the smallest it could ever look is if I put it at redshift of 1.7. If I put it nearby or if I put it farther away, it's going to look bigger on the sky. Guys, I was expecting somebody's head to explode, but it always happens in every class. Someone just wigs out, and then they run out of the class crying. No, that doesn't actually happen. So this is cool, right? Because this gets us now into this idea of being able to make measurements of distance in a very different way. And again, if all we're doing is basically coming up with a different way of measuring effectively luminosity distance, because this is actually these are related to each other simply by 1 plus z squared, then if I had a standard ruler on the sky and I could measure its size, apparent size on the sky, I'd have an independent way of basically measuring these cosmological parameters. Yes? Correct. Good. Yeah, good point. So there are really two standard rulers that we'll probably wind up discussing at some level of detail here. I may, if we have time in the last lecture this evening, I may talk about a third one. One is called the Sunyaev. Oh, no, I'm never going to spell that right. Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect. And the other is using the cosmic background radiation. We'll talk about this in great detail. I want to just sort of sketch out what's actually happening when I talk about the Sinyaev-Soldovich effect. Essentially, in the Sinyaev-Soldovich effect, you have photons which are moving through a cluster of galaxies. And those photons are actually coming from the cosmic background radiation. So the way we should be thinking about the cosmic background radiation is everywhere we look, we just see this sort of bath of photons with a certain temperature associated with them. We'll talk more about that in the last half of this lecture. So we've got all these photons heading towards us. Every now and then, some of those photons, or at least in one of these directions, those photons are actually coming through a cluster of galaxies. That cluster of galaxies, as we've seen before, has a lot of hot gas associated with it, and it has a lot of free electrons. The free electrons wind up interacting with the cosmic background radiation photons. Those free electrons have a typical sort of energy associated with them, which is related to their temperature. And what they actually wind up doing is, on average, giving a little boost to the cosmic background photons, as if basically these photons wind up appearing to get a little bit hotter because they get a little bit of an extra kick in our direction. So these photons more or less are zapping away energy from this hot gas, but at a very, very low level. And so when we look in certain places on the sky, we wind up seeing that there are hot spots. There are hot spots that have a scale on the sky, basically that of clusters. It's actually a very interesting way of discovering clusters. These photons get this kick. They wind up having apparently a slightly higher energy. And what's interesting about this, and the way we think about this in terms of a standard ruler, is that we can measure how much kick these things wind up getting. We can measure the physical size of this little splotch in the cosmic background radiation on the sky. We can also measure the X-ray, take an X-ray image of this cluster and figure out the sort of typical extent of this cluster. And what's interesting about this is that we can make measurements of distance. On the left-hand side, you see actual X-ray images of three different clusters on the far left panels, and then you see models of those clusters on the right side panels. And the way that they're plotting this, rather than showing you an image with all the X-ray photons, this is just plotted up in contours. So in the middle, obviously, that's the center of the cluster, and then on the outskirts, the X-ray flux is dropping off. On the right-hand side, what you wind up seeing happen to the cosmic background radiation spectrum is you wind up seeing it all shifted a little bit to higher frequency. And that shift is something that you can actually measure. And the way it manifests itself in sort of radio speak is that we could obviously measure this spectrum here as a function of frequency. But it just basically looks like that part in the sky is actually hot. The change in the temperature, delta T divided by T, is proportional to the integral of the electron density times the X-ray temperature times the path length that photon, those photons had to take to get to us. So if we think about the path length that the photons are taking, here's you, mythical you, like with your X-ray detectors in space, etc. And here is this distance, LR. That's usually subscripted with an R because this is the idea of a radial distance. And here's another distance we'll call L transverse or something, LT. What you can actually measure on the sky is this angle theta. You can measure basically the physical extent of the cluster's gas that's giving rise to this Sinyaev-Soldovich effect or SZ effect. But you can also, from this delta T, the change in the effective temperature, make a measurement of this LR. So you have a physical measurement, now in units basically of megaparsecs, of this thing, LR. And what you actually wind up measuring is theta, which is related to the transverse size of this. under the assumption that LR is approximately equal to LT, you can use this to figure out the angular diameter distance to that source. Right? So you're basically just saying, what's the angular diameter distance that gives me the right answer so that when I multiply theta by L of T, I wind up getting L of R. I'm not going into all the detailed physics of this, but I wanted you to know that this is one of the sort of really interesting ways of doing measurements of distance in cosmology. And the really interesting thing that's part of this, of course, is that this here, this delta T divided by T, is just basically related to microphysics of how photons interact with electrons. Right? It's that equation up there. And so if I have a way of measuring the electron density, remember we've done this before when we try to figure out how much matter was in the form of this hot gas. We actually went through the construction of how we did that. Does anyone remind me how we did that? How we figure out what NE is? Exactly. That stuff there is radiating with some characteristic temperature. The spectrum of that stuff is Bremsstrahlen. We can measure that temperature. And the overall luminosity is going to wind up being related to the density NE squared. Right? And so if you figure out what the distance to the source is, you have to know distance to the source to measure NE. Right? This is actually more complicated than I'm making it seem. NE also has units or has measurements of distance in it in a cosmological sense. So what you're also measuring when you do Sinyaev-Soldovich is a sort of complicated interplay between all these different cosmological parameters. But if you constrain these observables like delta T divided by T, you constrain T, you can actually wind up inferring distances. Here's one of the first plots using Sinyaev-Soldovich effect only to make a measurement of the Hubble constant. There's different cosmologies that are plotted here. And when I say different cosmologies, remember, I'm talking about different cosmological parameters. Here, people are really only interested in getting at the Hubble constant. And you can see that the error bars, these long things on the y-axis, are actually pretty large. But when you actually fit to the data, you wind up getting this reasonable range of cosmologies, which are encapsulated in those three different lines there. What's so remarkable about the measurement of angular diameter distance in the context of Sinyaev-Soldovich effect is that it doesn't rely on the distance ladder. The distance ladder is something we basically have to appeal to when we think about luminosity distance, because we need to figure out how bright those supernovae actually are in units of watts, right, at their peak. And we can only know that if we've got other measurements of supernovae in the nearby universe and can make an appeal to the idea that those things are going to be the same at higher redshift as they are in the local universe. Here, all we have to say is, I understand how photons interact with electrons. And yes, there's some uncertainties in all this, but you actually wind up getting cosmological measurements out of this. So this is a really hot topic. There are people, especially in the physics department here, who have been building large experiments to find lots of Sinyaev-Soldovich clusters to actually do cosmological work. And what's nice about this is it actually is a nice complement to supernovae work, because it actually measures a different juxtaposition of omega matter and omega lambda. One of the things I wanted to point out, and one of the reasons why these error bars are actually so large, is because we've already seen when we've talked about actual clusters is that no actual real cluster is perfectly virialized. No actual cluster is perfectly relaxed and perfectly spherical. So if I make a measurement of a cluster here and I say this measurement here is the same as this measurement here, and now I'm going into the board, I could be wrong, right? The cluster could be sort of football shaped, right? Or we could be fooled and it could just be longer in one direction. But the idea, of course, is that the universe isn't going to conspire against us and have all the clusters we look at be football-shaped and all heading in our direction. So if you look at enough of them, you wind up actually getting a reasonable statistical sample. Okay, any questions about that? All right. So cosmic background radiation. We kind of have to take a little bit of a step back before we start thinking about the CMB as a standard ruler. And I want to talk about the origin of the CMB. To do this, we have to go back in the history of the universe and think about what was happening at early times in the universe. In the early universe, what's the component of the Friedmann equation that winds up dominating the dynamics? It's the photons, right. We've ignored it when we think about the nearby universe, but if you think back in the Friedmann equation, the contribution is going to be increasing like 1 over r to the fourth power, whereas the contribution from omega matter is going to be increasing like 1 over 1 plus z to the third power. So it's at early times, radiation was dominating. We showed in the early universe where radiation dominates that the temperature of the universe was 1.5 times 10 to the 10 Kelvin, T in units of seconds to the minus 1/2 power, so it's going down. And likewise, R of T, we said, was 1.8 times 10 to the minus 10 T in units of seconds to the 1/2 power. Remember, we said that T times R is equal to some constant. That's because T times lambda is also equal to some constant. This is just Wien's law. So this is an irradiation-dominated universe. And it's actually OK if you make measurements locally today to throw out all those other terms. It makes, obviously, solving the Friedmann equation a lot easier. And we got to these answers here a few lectures ago. So the universe was hot. It was really hot. And the universe cooled. It really cooled. And it cooled like T to the minus 1/2 power. So as I just increase, you know, if I take T to be, you know, 10 to the 6, so a million seconds after the Big Bang, I'm cooler by a factor of 10 to the 3. I'm 1,000 times cooler, and I'm starting to get into something like 10,000 degrees Kelvin. So after 1,000 or after a million seconds, the universe is sort of the temperature of the interior of the sun, right? Just keep on playing this movie forward in time, and we wind up seeing how the temperature is dropping out. When the temperature is very high, obviously, it's very difficult to keep around neutral hydrogen. And in fact, what we'll wind up seeing in the last lecture when we talk about how protons, electrons, et cetera, were formed, this whole thing called baryogenesis, we know that protons and electrons were formed at different times in the universe. And in those times of the universe, it was so hot that it was very difficult to keep around neutral hydrogen. In fact, it was impossible to have neutral hydrogen. So when we think about hydrogen in the very early universe when it was very hot, we think about protons and electrons in a freely floating plasma. Now, that's sort of depicted up here in yellow. And we see sort of on the left-hand side, temperature is now increasing as I go up on the board. Redshift is now increasing as I go up on the board. At the top, we have this plasma, right, because the universe is hot. And the way we think about it is that the electrons and the protons were moving around so fast that they were freely ionizing each other. Photons were around, and they were also interacting with any neutral atoms which wound up being temporarily created and then having more than enough energy to ionize that atom. And then something magical happens. The universe just cools. And it cools just enough so that neutral atoms could actually wind up not only forming, but stay there and stay formed. The universe was fully ionized for the first, as we'll see, 300,000 years of its life. And then, basically, immediately thereafter, it became fully neutral. What's actually happening when we go to a neutral medium? We're getting a proton plus an electron, and we're getting a neutral hydrogen plus some photon, which is the ionization potential of hydrogen. That's, as we've said a number of times, 13.6 electron volts. And if we want to associate that with a temperature, KT, K, Boltzmann constant, 8.617 times 10 to the minus 5 electron volts per Kelvin. That means we're talking about a temperature of order 150,000 degrees Kelvin. This time is sometimes called recombination. It's a bit of a misnomer, because the idea, of course, is that these photons are sort of bouncing around and freely ionizing otherwise neutral atoms. And then all of a sudden, because photons don't interact as easily with neutral atoms as they do with freely floating electrons, all of a sudden, these photons just say, oh, there's nothing for me to interact with. There's nothing for me to scatter off of, right? And not only that, these photons see less electrons. These photons, on average, if I get to the right temperature, don't have nearly enough ionization potential to actually take a neutral hydrogen atom and ionize it. Because now, all of a sudden, the average energy of these photons is too low to do any of this ionization work. So we call this stuff recombination, but the reason why it's a misnomer, of course, is because these protons and electrons were never actually combined at the early times in the universe. So the way to really think about this is the first combination, right? It's when electrons and protons started getting together. So at the moment of that, not only are you getting essentially a fully neutral medium, you're also getting the photons decoupling from the hydrogen atoms. And so this is kind of this important moment when we call decoupling. This is when radiation and matter stop basically talking to each other in a very deep way, right? Before that time, radiation was doing what matter wanted to do. Matter was doing what radiation wanted to do. It was just a big soup. And then after that time, you all of a sudden get this neutral medium, and then all of a sudden radiation's like, oh, I can just keep on freely floating. The path length between me and the next time I'm going to wind up doing a significant scatter drops dramatically. And so when we think about path lengths, and we think about scattering, it's actually not too unreasonable to think about this as what's called the surface of last scattering. It's not a physical surface, like we can't land on it, right? We're never going to send people after Mars to the surface of last scattering. But it is this sort of moment in the universe where photons were sort of jumbled up beyond that moment, and then afterwards they just freely floated. And the photons we're observing now from the cosmic background radiation traveled all the way since the surface of last scattering to get to us to basically be detected. So when we think about the surface of last scattering, it's actually very reasonable to think about this as looking at some cloud bank, right? What is it when I look at that cloud out there? I'm basically looking at this sort of non-physical surface, but I'm looking at this region where beyond that region, photons are interacting very copiously with matter, in this case, water vapor. But then after that, those photons just head to us, right? Because all of a sudden, there's not enough water vapor and the photons are capable of getting all the way to our eyes. It's exactly, or it's analogously the same thing happening on the left-hand side as what you see on the right-hand side. The surface of last scattering is a sort of last moment in the history of the universe where we can't actually see beyond that, right? It's actually a real fog bank. It's a real veil, and it's basically impossible for us to actually see physical structures beyond that, because the physical structures are basically distorted by the interactions of all the photons, right? Another way to think about it is you're sort of looking through a shower door where everything beyond that gets completely disrupted and you can't actually make out physical shapes. Not that you're actively trying to do that. I should work on my analogies before I bring them up in class. Anyway, think about it as a cloud if you want. Any questions about that? I'll get into the physics of the last scattering in a second, but I wanted people to just see this. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the physics of this process here. And we'll wind up seeing that this temperature is actually way too high for us to calculate the effective temperature where this scattering happens, or this recombination happens, or matter and radiation decouple. They're all basically the same thing. It turns out that if we want to figure out when the universe was half neutral and half ionized, we have to now appeal to something called the Saha equation. I think you all did a lot of this in 7A, so I'm sorry, you guys are having nightmares in the middle of the day. The Saha equation basically tells us how an ionized gas and a neutral gas are related to each other in number density. And we have hydrogen atoms, so this sort of makes life very easy. It says that the number density of protons times the number density of electrons divided by the number density of hydrogen atoms, I'll subscript it with a little zero here, that's neutral atoms, is equal to 2 pi times the mass of an electron times the temperature, kT, divided by Planck's constant squared to the 3/2 power, e to the minus ionization potential divided by kT. If we want to now define the ionization fraction, we'll call it x, and that's just equal to the number density of electrons divided by the total number density of all the particles around. Right? So when this is equal to 1/2, it means that I'm basically half neutral, or if you want to see the glass half empty or half full, you're half half ionized. Now, there's some sort of clever tricks that that one can do. They're actually not that clever. The idea, of course, is that we have baryon conservation. So baryon conservation tells us that the number of protons plus the number of hydrogen atoms is just equal to the total number density of all the baryons. So the number density of hydrogen atoms is just n divide, minus m, np, but np is also equal to ne because of charge conservation and charge neutrality. So this allows us to plug back in for what we have over here, and without going through all the algebra, you'll wind up doing this on your homework. It's just one or x squared divided by one minus x is equal to one divided by the number density as a function of the dimensionless scale factor in the universe, then all that stuff inside there, 2 pi me kt divided by h squared to the 3/2 power, and then e to the minus chi h divided by kt, now also as a function of r. In a universe which is dominated by either photons or by matter, we can actually figure out how this number density of matter is changing as a function of the dimensionless scale factor. Temperature is trivially related to the dimensionless scale factor, right? As the dimensionless scale factor is lower, temperature is higher, they're inversely related to each other. So you can replace these values of T of R, with basically T0, the temperature we observe today, divided by R, or 1 plus Z. And likewise here, we can decide how we want to replace the number density relative to terms that we can actually measure today. Now, a little bit of the trick is sort of knowing that the answer, when x is equal to 0.5, you can now basically solve for redshift. And this is the exercise you're going to wind up doing in your problem set. So I won't go through all of that, but I will give you part of the answer, because it's in your book. And you wind up getting that for a half-neutralized universe, this important redshift of matter-radiation decoupling is equal to 1,089. Again, for the parameters that we use from your book, from the WMAP experiment. And this corresponds to a temperature in the universe of 2,970 degrees Kelvin. The time of recombination in the universe is 379 times 10 to the 3 years. So when this happened in the universe, the temperature was about 3,000 degrees Kelvin. It's much, much lower than this temperature associated with the ionization potential. And that basically comes out of the Saha ionization equation that tells us how we get this admixture of half neutral and half ionized. The temperature of the cosmic background radiation that we observe today is 2.725 degrees Kelvin. I'll go through in a second sort of the history of this, but I wanted people just to see that using the Saha equation, I can now actually, so I could ask you, when was the universe populated by only 1% of ionized hydrogen atoms, or 99% of hydrogen atoms? And you wind up seeing that there's a redshift range when that actually happens. So the surface of last scattering is not an actual moment, a single moment. It's a small epoch in the history of the universe. And you'll wind up deriving in your homework what that sort of range is in redshift space, and you'll then translate that into the age of the universe at the time, and also the sort of change of that universe time over that range. So it turns out this happens over a very quick period in time. All right. Any questions about ionization potential, Saha equation, what it means when I go from being fully ionized to fully neutral? Okay, you're going to see a lot of that in your homework. You're going to be so happy. Cosmic background radiation, a bit of history of this. It's kind of fun, of course. These two folks were working for Bell Labs, Wilson and Penzias. And they built this big radio receiver you see in the back. They were basically trying to figure out how to receive radio waves at the millimeter regime and for communication purposes. And they built this thing, they tested it, and they started taking data with it, and they wound up seeing that they had noise that was seemingly coming from all different directions on the sky. They, it turns out, didn't actually know that this noise was a cosmic background radiation, and they certainly didn't know that this cosmic background radiation was actually a prediction of the Big Bang Theory. The idea that the universe started and was very hot and then cooled down leads you directly, if you believe Saha and you believe basic physics of how radiation and matter are coupled to each other, leads directly to this idea that you should have some sort of overall temperature. There should be this actual moment of decoupling, and we should have this moment of less scattering. And then because the universe kept on expanding, this radiation wound up cooling. These guys didn't know that. So they were a little bit freaked out, and they thought they had a problem with their detector, so they did everything they could to try to fix the detector. And then they found a family of homing pigeons living inside, and they thought that all this noise was coming from the stuff the homing pigeons produce on a daily basis. So they cleaned all that stuff out, and then they got rid of the homing pigeons, and the noise was still there. And then the homing pigeons came back later and said, whatever. And they really had no idea what was going on. So they wound up talking with and interacting with some physicists in Princeton who, of course, knew this idea that there could be this leftover radiation. The really interesting thing is, no matter where they looked on the sky, they got the same answer of what this noise property was. And noise for a radio receiver is the equivalent to a temperature. And we've now been able to measure this temperature very precisely. This is from the COBE experiment. John Mather was a postdoc here at Berkeley when he devised this experiment. And he won the Nobel Prize 2 years ago in physics, basically, for the actual very precise measurement of the cosmic background radiation. And I've been referring to the CMB for a long time as this thing that has a temperature. It's got these photons associated with it. And what you see here is plotted basically a black body with this characteristic temperature of 2.7 whatever degrees Kelvin. And what's kind of neat about this is we believe this is the best black body ever measured by mankind. So we're able to measure this black body to one part in something like 10 to the 6, and we wind up seeing that it fits perfectly the Planck curve. When you look all over the sky, and you now figure out what the effective temperature is on the sky. This is the projection on the sky of the whole 2D celestial sphere. The galactic center is in the center, as you can see. The galactic plane is along the side here. Your eye can't discern anything, right? It truly was, as Penzias and Wilson, who also wound up winning a Nobel Prize for this, it truly was and truly is a sort of uniform temperature on most of the scales that we were able to measure in the early days. However, if you subtract off this average value over the sky, you wind up seeing something else. You wind up seeing this sort of yin-yangy shape on the sky. And the yin-yangy shape is actually due to something which we don't believe is a cosmological in origin. It's because we believe that the Milky Way and the Earth around the solar system within the Milky Way, everything is moving with respect to the local Hubble flow. And because the Earth and the Milky Way are moving with respect to the local Hubble flow, we're actually heading in one direction towards the cosmic background radiation. In a physical sense, our galaxy is moving at whatever, 300 kilometers a second, what do we say here, 371 kilometers a second, in some direction. And that some direction gives rise to an effect where in some directions we wind up seeing slightly shorter wavelengths and slightly higher wavelengths, which means we see slightly different temperatures. This is purely a Doppler effect. So we wind up seeing this yin-yangy pattern. It's called the dipole because of Milky Way's motion basically through the local Hubble flow. What's kind of neat about this is we can now figure out how the Milky Way is moving relative to how it ought to be moving relative to the metric that it's living on. Anyone's head explode? So this dipole is really there. If you remove the dipole, so now you have a model for us heading in this direction, so it's going to be hotter in that direction, and if I look back behind me, it's going to look colder in that direction, you wind up seeing something else at a much smaller level. You see, it might be difficult to see in the back, but these changes in the effective temperature from really cold to really hot, of now 18 microkelvin relative to 2.728 Kelvin at the top here. And what do you see that pops out when I remove the dipole? You see the Milky Way. Their physical processes, actually synchrotron radiation, because they're magnetic fields and there's free electrons moving in these magnetic fields that produce emission that's associated with the galactic plane. But then you see this other splotchy stuff here, and you go, what is that? This is on such large scales that it's really hard to figure out how this stuff could actually be sort of coherent on these big scales, coherent big cold spots and coherent big hot spots. What's one way that I said you could get a coherent big hot spot in the cosmic background? Yeah, Sinyaev-Sildovich effect. That turns out that that's only as big as the biggest clusters on the sky, and that's not nearly as big as these big splotches. You could put something really nearby, like on the outer solar system, right, and have something that's sort of a physical size of like, you know, several tens of AU, and have it have a different electron density and sort of a local Sinyaev-Sildovich. We don't think that's what's happening. What we're actually seeing here is difference in temperatures at the surface of last scattering. It's like I look at this cloud, and this cloud is outside isn't perfectly uniform. Some parts of it are a little more gray. Some parts are a little more white. Likewise, in the surface of last scattering, there are places on the sky where the temperature is slightly higher and the temperature is slightly lower. This is sometimes affectionately referred to as the ripples of God, or basically what started it all. And that also won Professor Smoot in the physics department his Nobel Prize for his work on what these ripples actually are. These ripples are real. The stuff in the middle here is just from the galaxy. We can get rid of that stuff. These ripples are real, and they have a lot to do with how the universe was evolving until the moment of decoupling, until this moment of last scattering. And what you can imagine is that this moment of last scattering is also going to wind up being related to cosmological parameters. We're starting to get to this way of using these things as standard rulers. So that was from an experiment called COBE. We now have this experiment called WMAP that I've been referring to often throughout this class. WMAP has made this beautiful picture, and I can go back and forth. You can see that there are some things here, like hotspots, that wind up persisting here now with better resolution than COBE was able to do. And these are the true ripples that give rise to the formation of galaxies and clusters and structures in the universe. And these ripples were there and present at the time of decoupling. Another way to visualize this is on a sphere. So now you're standing in the center of this, looking outwards and looking at these ripples. We've now removed all the contributions from the galaxy. Yes, Jonah. Say that again. Minus 200 Kelvin up to 200 Kelvin or microkelvin is the difference relative to the average temperature, and they've also removed the dipole contribution, which would be a huge effect. So that's it, right? That's the origin of structure in the universe, which we can sort of see implanted on that surface of last scattering. Let's talk a little bit about that. I'll just go back, get myself a black space. And think a little bit about what the meaning is of temperature differences in different parts on this surface of last scattering. Well, the easy thing to think about is that for some reason, the universe wasn't perfectly uniform. This is the origins. Of the ripples in the cosmic background radiation, CMB. And the M stands for microwave. The idea is that we have some perturbations in the early universe. So the universe we think of as almost perfectly uniform. It's isotropic and homogeneous in all directions. But there's small differences from that, right? There has to be. If everything was exactly the same, how could you form a galaxy over there or a galaxy cluster over there and not over there, right? So there has to be densities that are slightly higher than the average density of the universe, and likewise, there has to be densities that are slightly lower. The way to think about these perturbations now in sort of units of, say, delta rho in the early universe is that we have places on the sky or places in the universe where the densities are slightly higher and places where they're slightly lower. And places where we have slightly higher densities, you can imagine, start filling up with lots of stuff, right? Let me see if I can do this way. In places of lots of stuff, I'm going to wind up sort of flowing in and having more matter here. So in places of higher density, you imagine that these density perturbations can wind up growing. And likewise, because I have a higher density, I get all this stuff. It's flowing in. It winds up interacting more. I wind up having higher temperatures. So densities and temperatures, as we'll see mathematically when we start the last lecture, are actually related to each other. But these wind up manifesting themselves as hot spots. These are cold spots, hot spots, and cold spots. Before recombination, matter and photons were talking to each other a lot. And whenever I had a small perturbation in matter, for whatever reason, you wind up getting really hot. And then you wind up having more sort of ionizations. You wind up having more diffusion of that temperature out. Because it's basically a fluid, right? It's a plasma. It's a fluid at early times. And so because matter is coupled strongly with radiation, radiation actually serves to sort of damp out most of matter's perturbations. But we have to be careful. What is it that I talk about when I've been talking about matter so far? I've been talking about ordinary matter. I've been talking about baryons. I've been talking about hydrogen and even helium atoms talking and strongly coupled with photons. But what's the other matter in the universe that doesn't talk very strongly with photons? Dark matter. In the early universe, as sort of this cosmic dance of hydrogen atoms and photons were continuing, dark matter was like, I'm going to do my thing, right? I'm so decoupled from all of you. I'm so cool, or I'm so hot, or whatever. I'm going to have the perturbations that I started off with actually wind up growing. And then, you know, you wind up sort of having ordinary matter come in, and then you have the radiation try to sort of remove and smooth that stuff out. And then so you remove the ordinary matter, but you wind up having large perturbations in the dark matter. So what we're actually seeing when we see these ripples in the cosmic background radiation are the primordial places on the sky where dark matter was already starting to pool up at the time of recombination. When you think about sort of this surface of last scattering and the ripples on it, the way to think about it is that places where perturbations happen started in the very, very early universe, and those perturbations actually propagated out, again, in this context of this fluid. The way to think about these ripples is that I have, sort of a big pond, which we'll call the early universe, and then I throw a piece of chalk or a piece of rock into that pond, and the ripples have some time to propagate out. And the time that it takes to propagate out, or the size it's going to wind up propagating out to, is the sound speed of how fast sort of sound travels in this plasma times the age of the universe. So if I threw this like rock into this otherwise placid pond, and then I wind up seeing this ripple propagate outwards, if I knew how fast waves move in water, and I knew how long it's been, I could actually figure out the physical size of these ripples. But we don't just have one perturbation in the universe, we have lots of perturbations. And so the way to think about it now is not just somebody throwing a rock into a placid pond, but raindrops coming down over this whole pond. If you look at the spectrum of ripples and the connections of the locations of different ripples, you know, every single one of these places where it's slightly higher now in the pond context, and we might think about this as densities in the universe context, are talking in some sense to all the other places where they're all high, right? And if I had a big raindrop that came in 10 seconds ago, there is now some sort of characteristic scale where everything on that scale should wind up being about the same height, right? And they should all wind up being slightly higher. So when we look at perturbations of the microwave background, and the way we actually do measurements of perturbations in the microwave background, is we look at sort of the correlations on the sky in angular units of hotspots. How far is away, if I'm on a hotspot, how far away am I till the next hotspot? Or if I'm on a cool spot, how far away there? And what we're actually doing is measuring what's called the power spectrum. This is basically, for those of you that have seen Fourier transforms and things, this is kind of a Fourier transform on a two-dimensional sphere. What we're looking at is a function of multiple moment. I'll define more of that stuff later on. But effectively, it's 1 over the angle on the sky. I'm looking at the effect of power. And what you see is that even though it kind of looks like noise when I look at that stuff there, there's actually some sort of characteristic scale where if I'm on a hotspot, I only have to go a certain distance until I go to another hotspot. It's not completely random. If it was random, this power spectrum would be completely flat. You notice, and forget about the units here, this is units of temperature squared, et cetera, there's a place on the sky when you get a whole lot of power, meaning if I'm on a hotspot, I have a very high probability of moving that distance on the sky of getting another hotspot. That distance is about 1 degree. It's 1.05 degrees. Don't have to memorize that, but that's good to know. And then there's other little wiggles and stuff here. These little wiggles are more or less sort of acoustic modes of this very large sort of boom that happened that gave us this characteristic scale on the sky. And what we'll wind up seeing is we can use the location of this multiple moment to make measurements of cosmological parameters. And what's very cool is that you can take real data, that's real data at the top there, and you can change parameters, change the Hubble constant, change what omega k is. Remember, 1 minus omega is equal to omega k. And when it gets to 0, you wind up seeing that we have a pretty nice fit there. And then there's other things like the primordial power spectrum of perturbations, et cetera. It turns out that WMAP data in combination with the measurement of Hubble constant in the local universe is very, very accurate. We've entered what's called the era of precision cosmology because we can look at these ripples in the cosmic background radiation and try to fit to the data. and we get very accurate measurements on cosmological parameters. All right, so we'll pick up tonight at 5:10, Evans 264. We'll actually go through the mathematics of these different ripples and see how we can use those as standard rulers. And then we'll get to the very early universe, and we'll talk about the creation of ordinary matter, and we'll get back into the Big Bang, and we'll talk about crazy universes, different or similar to our own.